Good afternoon. Today is Monday, the 15th of April, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host today. With me in the studio, I'm very pleased to say, is Mike Robinson. And because of the special events over the weekend, we are... Who's joining us today, Mike?
Vanessa Beely.
Vanessa Beely, absolutely. Thank you very much for that. Now, I'm just going to add that if you think the backdrop to us in Plymouth is tropical today, having just been out, it's a lot colder than it looks. So we'll just give that little instant weather report here from the southwest of England. Well, Vanessa, really incredible things happening over the weekend. What have you got for us?
Yes. Skies over Damascus were quite exciting. So let's just get straight into what has been happening. This was ahead of the Financial Times. As you said, Brian, just before we came on, the juxtaposition of the images there, kind of shouty Iran on the left, the missiles getting intercepted, and Netanyahu looking very serious and intellectual on the telephone. Fight them the night that Iran's missile spectacle rattled Israel. So let's have a look at what it says in the Financial Times. In Israel, where the assault had long been anticipated, this is a very important point. Iran's attack had been made very clear for at least 10 days so that the US and the UK had time to get into place with whatever air defenses they would provide for Israel. And Israel also had plenty of time to prepare itself for this attack. It wasn't a surprise attack. Around the same time as Netanyahu's plane, the Wing of Zion took off for safety from Nevatim Air Base as the missiles approached. Dozens of fighter aircraft and defensive systems were deployed to fend off the attack. Not just Israeli, but British, Jordanian, and American. So Jordan made it very clear on whose side it will be if there is an escalation of conflict. Now, according to the FT, and this ties in with many of the independent commentators that I've been speaking to, Iran's aerial assault on Israel, 120 ballistic missiles, 30 cruise missiles, and leading the way, 170 UAVs or drones. Now, according to the Financial Times, it says that these drones, on the next slide, if we can, is some of which, the Shahed 136, are similar to those Russia has unleashed in Ukraine, have proven easy to take down. Now, they weren't really being used as attack drones. They were being used as advanced probe scouting drones to suss out the Israeli air defense. Even Ukraine's limited air defenses have taken them down. At the same time, and this is the important sector in the FT, an Israeli official said that the swarm of drones was designed to probe Israel's responses and track the locations and trajectories of its defensive assets. They learned a lot about us, and we learned a little about them, said the official. It was an education. Very, very important point. Let's flip there by the FT. At the same time, in Western media, we've barely seen any reporting on the unity, the solidarity of the resistance axis, which included Iraq, Yemen, Syria, the resistance factions inside Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah. Who attacked the air and missile defense headquarters in the Qila barracks in the occupied Syrian Jolan with dozens of Katyusha rockets as the Iranian missiles were incoming. What was the reaction from the US and the UK? Well, Rishi Sunak, of course, came out immediately, having not condemned the Israeli terrorist aggression against an Iranian embassy in Damascus 10 days prior, but condemned Iran's reckless attack on Israel in the strongest terms. And we have the video relating to Rishi's comments.
Well, last night, Iran launched a barrage of missiles and attack drones across the Middle East towards Israel. This was a dangerous and unnecessary escalation, which I've condemned in the strongest terms. Thanks to an international coordinated effort, which the United Kingdom participated in, almost all of these missiles were intercepted, saving lives not just in Israel, but in neighbouring countries like Jordan as well. The RAF sent additional planes to the region as part of our existing operations to counter Daesh in Iraq and Syria. I can confirm that our planes did shoot down a number of Iranian attack drones, and I want to pay tribute to the bravery and professionalism of our pilots flying into the face of danger to protect civilians.
So RAF jets did shoot down Iranian attack drones. Are you able to say what future involvement the RAF and the UK could have as this develops? And what was the process leading up to that last night? Did you consult the cabinet at all?
As I said, the RAF moved additional planes into the region as part of our existing operations to counter Daesh in Iraq and Syria. And I can confirm that a number of Iranian attack drones were shot down. And we've paid tribute to the bravery and the professionalism of our pilots flying into the face of danger to protect civilians. I chaired a COBRA meeting on Friday to agree a plan of action.
So I think my comment on this one straight off is, of course, a modest response from the UK there with planes in the area. Was there any real discussion in parliamentary terms? He went into the COBRA meeting. What does that mean? He was already in a protected circle of people making the decision, so it didn't go through a vote in Parliament.
But we have a second clip?
We do, yeah. Let's have a look at the second one, yeah.
Have you spoken to Benjamin Netanyahu, and what is your message to him as he considers how Israel responds to this?
Well, as I said yesterday, it's clear that Iran is determined to sow discontent and destabilise the region, its own backyard. That's very clear from its actions. If this attack had been successful, the fallout for regional stability would be hard to overstate. And we stand by the security of Israel and the wider region, which is, of course, important for our security here at home too. And what we now need is for calm heads to prevail. We'll be working with our allies to de-escalate the situation, and I look forward to speaking to G7 leaders later this afternoon.
What practically can the UK do to try and de-escalate now? Is this predominantly about dialogue, or could there be conditions set on military support, as was last night, dependent on how Israel responds?
Well, I'll be talking to G7 leaders later this afternoon. It's important that we coordinate with allies, and we'll be discussing next steps at that moment.
So, Vanessa, I'll just say, of course, he didn't answer the very first question about a dialogue with Netanyahu. That was just ignored. He got back onto his press briefing. And I think he is deeply rattled. I think the whole of the US and Western alliance is deeply rattled because, as we're going to see a little bit later, things did not go as calmly as they'd like us to believe. So, Rishi, Sorry, Vanessa. Go ahead.
No, sorry. I was just going to say absolutely, and I thought he actually looked distinctly uncomfortable in both those clips. And interesting that, of course, they will send defense for Israel against a retaliatory attack from Iran, but they can't send defense for the millions of Gazans that are, well, the million and a half of Gazans, 50% children, that are effectively being massacred on a daily basis. So back to Joe Biden, his statement, of course, he completely condemns the Iranian attack without any context whatsoever. And this was very much picked up by the Russian ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, in his address, which I've included just a clip of here.
To see. You know very well that an attack against a diplomatic representation is a casus belli under international law. And if a Western representation had been hit, you would immediately have rained down reprisals and would argued that you were right about this in this very chamber. And this is because for you, everything that has to do with Western representations and Western citizens is sacred. It needs to be protected. But when it comes to other countries, their rights, including the right to self-defense, about their nationals, well, that's a different matter, as you like to say. What happens then is you activate your favorite argumentation about lack of information, you start doing legalistic hair splitting, etc. And today in the Security Council, what we're witnessing is a display of hypocrisy and double standards, which it's almost embarrassing to watch. Russia has warned on many an occasion that the fact that many crises in the Middle East are unsettled, first and foremost in the area of Israeli and Palestinian conflict, which are frequently fueled by irresponsible, unilateral and provocative acts, will lead to a growth of tension in the whole region. We have stated on many an occasion that no country in the Middle East or Northern Africa should become an arena for regional or international confrontation or an arena for settling political scores. What happened in the night of the 14th of April did not happen in a vacuum. The steps undertaken by Iraq became a reaction to a disgraceful inaction by the Security Council. And a reaction to an egregious attack by Israel against Damascus, and not the first one, because Syria is constantly being bombarded.
I mean, you know, it's difficult to argue with what he said, and this is the context for the attack from Iran. It wasn't only the attack against the embassy itself, although that was really the final straw, the red line. But if we look at since October the 7th, the number of IRGC officers assassinated inside Syria is unprecedented. Now, if we're going to look at what missiles did hit target, according again to independent reports, the following two maps demonstrate that it was the Ramon airport to the south of Israel and the Nevatim airport sort of in central, near the Negev desert of Israel. And interestingly, although Israel and the UK and the US are echoing those claims, Israel is claiming that 99% of missiles and drones were intercepted. Apparently, about an hour before I came on, a US official told ABC News at least 9 missiles got through, 5 ballistic missiles hit Nevatim airport, causing damage to a C-130 transport plane, to the runway and storage facilities. Perhaps the most important, both those airports were considered to have been involved, by the way, in the targeting of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. And in fact, Mount Hermon, the intelligence and surveillance base, was also hit in the occupied Jalan territories again. That is considered to have been responsible for many of the hits on IRGC, military advisors inside Syria since October the 7th. So let's have a look at this claim. This was in the Times of Israel. 99% of the 320 or so projectiles fired by Iran at Israel overnight, they're claiming, were intercepted. So let's have a see. Sorry, let's have a look at what the IDF commander Haggari said. The Iranian threat met the aerial and technological superiority of the IDF, combined with a strong fighting coalition, which together intercepted the vast majority of the threat. Now, this is an interesting point, because in my understanding, there were actually an outer circle of air defense, which was effectively US, UK, and Jordanian fighter planes intercepting missiles, particularly in Syrian airspace. I mean, I didn't manage to get a good video of it, but it was quite exciting overhead at one point, because we actually had warplanes from the US and the UK particularly trying to intercept Iranian missiles, and then Syrian air defense trying to intercept the interceptors. So we had mass explosions over Syria, which was quite an extraordinary phenomenon. So he basically said 170 drones, not one entered Israeli airspace. 30 cruise missiles were launched, not a single one entered Israeli airspace. 25 were downed out of 30. In addition, Haggari says Iran fired 120 ballistic missiles. Many of them were downed. Now, this is a strange discrepancy. He's not being very outright in how many were downed by the long-range Arrow air defense system, although some of the missiles managed to bypass their defenses. He also claims that the damage at Nevatim was negligible. So then let's have a look. Press TV, of course, is saying that all the hypersonic missiles used in the Iran strike against Israel hit targets. I mean, I think, you know, we're going to have to take some kind of mean figure here or medium figure here. But Brian, I think you've done some work on this. These are just images that have been released in the last 24 hours of missile casing, seemingly undamaged, that has been found in the occupied territories. And I just wanted to play, this is a little medley that I made of one of my favorite US spokespeople, John Kirby, during an interview in which I think he was asked at least six times whether the US was going to support Israel if Israel decided to retaliate. Let's just play his responses, and I'm sure you will agree with me, this is quite an extraordinary performance.
I think Stan this morning is just an incredible military achievement by Israel and, quite frankly, the United States and other partners that helped Israel defend itself against more than 300 drones and missiles. I mean, it's just an extraordinary example of military superiority that Israel demonstrated to the whole world last night. And I think Israel also demonstrated that it has friends, that it's not standing alone, that it's not isolated on the world stage. What Israel demonstrated last night was an incredible ability to defend itself. Just their own military superiority was quite remarkable yesterday. I mean, very little got through, and the damage was extraordinarily light. And also, Israel demonstrated again, as I said, that they're not standing alone, that they have friends. So delivered to the prime minister, he congratulated the prime minister and the IDF for the extraordinary job they did knocking things out of the sky. Another here, since Israel hasn't made any decisions that I'm aware of about what the next step is. They performed extraordinarily well last night. And it really was a largely unsuccessful attack by Iran. That is noteworthy, and that should be remembered. And again, as I said earlier, it wasn't that they didn't do it alone. They had the United States.
I mean, I don't really think I need to comment further on that. It was an extraordinary performance. And I have to say, the interviewer was incredibly persistent. So this was in Middle East Monitor. Countering Iran's overnight attack cost Israel $1.35 billion. This is from the Israeli media. One Arrow missile used to intercept cost $3.5 million, while the cost of one Magic Wand missile is $1 million. Now, what is interesting is that obviously we're not hearing how much it costs the UK and the US to carry out the majority of the interceptions. That has also been admitted by the IOF. And I just also wanted to play an interview masterfully managed by Professor Mohammad Mirandi from Tehran on Sky News, where he also talks about the missiles that we use.
The two bases were severely damaged, but Iran has a huge stockpile of drones and missiles, and Iran hasn't used its most advanced weapons. So if there's...
What would they be, Professor? Nuclear weapons?
No, they're more advanced drones and missiles. Iran is not like the United States, which has and uses and has already used nuclear weapons. Iran's peaceful program, as we've seen over the years, has been peaceful, and there's never been any evidence to show otherwise. But Iran has more advanced drones and missiles. And the very fact that the Americans don't want to be a part of any Israeli counter-response shows that the Americans know where the power lies. So the smart thing for the Israeli regime to do would be to refrain from responding. They got their punishment and they should live with it. They can say that 200% of the drones were down and 300% of the missiles were down. But as long as they keep quiet, they'll be safe. But if they strike Iran again, it's going to get much worse.
I think what's very interesting, the issue immediately was raised of nuclear missiles here. And yet Israel has one of the most secretive clandestine nuclear warfare programs that, as far as I know, has never been inspected. Another point to make about this attack by Iran is that no civilians were hurt except for one young girl, a Bedouin girl, who unfortunately was actually hurt by the shrapnel falling from an intercepted missile. Now, I also have to point out that every time Israel attacks Syria, that also is a regular occurrence, that people are hurt by the shrapnel of intercepted missiles and buildings are damaged, etc. These images have been circulating since yesterday of Israeli airports and what appears to be settlers in large numbers leaving and departing from Israel, one presumes because of the security issues. And I just wanted to end on what I believe Iran has gained from this attack. It now has, as admitted by Israeli media, detailed knowledge of Israel's air defense and strategy, It has demonstrated the unity of the resistance axis. So in other words, if there is a future expansion of the conflict, then it's obvious who its allies are in the region, and that, of course, they also were not collaborating to their full capacity. It was an unprecedented, historic direct attack by Iran on Israel, which, of course, increases the deterrence factor. And also, I wanted to make one point. It was an only one wave of attacks, not several. So when the drones, when the layers of drones, cruise missiles and ballistic missiles had broken through the defense, it would normally be followed up by subsequent waves, which would have completed the destruction of the target. So it was clear, one, that Iran was restrained, and two, that this was intended to be, as it was described, a slap in the face for Israel after their egregious attack on Damascus. As I mentioned, no civilian deaths, unlike when Israel attacks, of course, even on the attack on the embassy, there were at least 8 civilian deaths during that attack. They used relatively low-grade UAVs and missiles to probe the Israeli air defense. It was a huge cost to Israel, the US, UK, and Jordan. Jordan's reputation right now will be in tatters, even amongst its own population. And the cost to Iran, according to Iranian officials, rests at about 38 to 62 million for the entire operation. Insecurity, as I mentioned, in Israel and settler exodus, potential outcome. And there was also an extremely successful 2 or 3 cyber attack prior to the launch of the missiles. So I think all in all, this was a successful operation for Iran.
Okay, Vanessa, thank you very much for that. Well, I agree with your analysis there. I've got a little bit more to do myself, but let's start off by having a look at David Cameron talking about events.
We're living in a very dangerous world. We know that because of what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in the Middle East and elsewhere. And what Iran did was a very, very dangerous act in an already dangerous world. And your report was completely right. But when we think about the 301 weapons that were fired at Israel, they weren't all drones. There were 110 ballistic missiles. There were 43 cruise missiles. This was a very significant attack. But fortunately, it was a failure because of the brave action of Israeli defenses and what the Americans did and our limited role, which I can come on to. And so in many ways, Iran has suffered a double defeat, the almost complete failure of their attack. And also by making this attack, they've revealed to the world their true nature as the malign influence in the region.
So I think that's an extremely worried David Cameron. He's looking very drawn and tired, and I think he's having to absolutely stay to script. What is interesting, of course, is he's claiming it's an Israeli victory. I agree with your analysis, Vanessa, on this. But also he's mentioning figures, and this will be my main point, because he talked about a total of 301 missiles. And as we'll see, the figures around the number of missiles used is very interesting. Let's have a look at this film clip by Professor Michael Clark, who Sky News in particular has used to do analysis not only on what's happening in the Middle East the latest with Iran, but also in Ukraine as well. Let's have a look.
Let's start with the Iranians. People talk a lot about a calibrated response. What do you think the Iranians hoped to achieve last night?
They certainly hoped to achieve some hits, and they got some. They seem to have got 7 hits on the Nevatim air base, which is symbolically important to them, because the Nevatim base is the base, it's the F-35 base, it's a big air base in the Negev Desert, which is where...
F-35 fighters.
Exactly. The F-35s took off from there to bomb the consulate in Syria, in Damascus, on the 1st of April. So, as far as the Iranians are concerned, they've hit the base from which the strike against their consulate was launched. So, symbolically, that's important. It is reported that they've done some damage to outbuildings, but there is no casualties. It has been reported around the Arab world that the base has completely been wiped off the map, which is clearly not true. So, they got 7 ballistic missiles through. They launched, it seems, this is from IDF figures, the Israeli defense figures, they launched 110 ballistic missiles and 7 of them got through. They launched 36 cruise missiles, none of them got through. They launched 185 drones, none of them got through. So statistically, less than 1% of their missiles got through, but the 7 ballistic missiles that may, if all 7 hit the air base, that gives them a symbolic victory. So, you know, any reasonable person might say, well, that's tit for tat in terms of Damascus on the 1st of April and now the base from which the attack was launched now. Maybe that should be an end to it. Any reasonable person might say that. But we're dealing here with Netanyahu as Prime Minister and Ali Khamenei as the Supreme Leader.
And
so
we are not talking about reasonable.
Neither
reasonable,
of them are particularly reasonable.
The situation doesn't make anybody reasonable.
No, exactly. I mean, and this is, you know, this round of conflict, this particular iteration, started with the Israelis going after IRGC generals and, you know, in an embassy. Now, going after IRGC generals is acceptable in the sense that they are attacking Israel, and so Israel goes after them wherever they can find them. But going after them in a consular building in Damascus is specifically against international law. It's very provocative. The Israelis seem to do it out of the blue, almost as if they wanted to provoke Iran to see how much Iran would do in response. And the Iranians are now saying that this is the end of it. They have said, this is our response. 7 out of 331 missiles got through. That's a pretty low percentage. But if the symbolism of hitting the airbase is good enough, then maybe they'll say, that's it, we don't want any more.
So this is where it gets fascinating for me. Very defensive interview by the professor there, but he ends up by saying that 7 out of 331 got through. I think you'll find that's closer to 2%. And if you looked at the comments under the interview itself, it was incredible what people were picking up. They were actually making fun of this man because, of course, a lot of his projections in Ukraine have been badly wrong over the last 2 years. But if we just bring the map up on screen, this highlights what Vanessa was talking about, is that the attacks were not just from Iran. They were coming from the Eastern Hemisphere, so Syria, Iraq, and Jordan, and flights from Yemen as well. So this was causing big problems to the Israeli defences. But this was the headline, that essentially only 1% that got through, but this is not true. And if we have a look at the comments in more detail, we can start to see how the figures were being massaged and manipulated as the dialogue went on. So he said they got 7 hits on the Nevatim air base, which is symbolic for them because that's where the F-35s took off from that attacked the Iranian consulate in Damascus. They got 7 ballistic missiles through. They launched from the IDF figures, he's saying. They launched 110 ballistic missiles and 7 of them got through. This, I think, would have been immensely significant to the US and the Allies. They launched 36 cruise missiles and none of them got through. They launched 185 drones, none of them got through. Let's follow it on. But the 7 ballistic missiles that hit, it may have been all 7 hit the Nevatim air base that got through. That gives them, and he's talking about Iran, a symbolic victory. But if we come back to his comments, so statistically, less than 1% of their missiles got through. But of course, if it's 7 missiles out of the 110 ballistic missiles, it's over 6% that got through. So now we start to see that everything is getting very wobbly in the Western dialogue. So we're teasing him here because he's a professor, so presumably he should be good at basic maths. But the truth is that 7 missiles out of 331 itself is over 2%. And as I've just said, if it's 7 out of the ballistic missiles, which is what he says, that is over 6%. So is he having trouble staying to the script? But here's the key point. But the ones that really bothered them, and he's talking about Israel and the US-UK allies, it was the ballistic missiles that got through. And this is what really says to me that actually the allies, Israel and their allies at the moment, are going to be deeply disturbed. So the claim is out of the 110, 103 were intercepted. That's not important. What's important is the 7 that did actually get through. And people can check the maths here, but it's pretty straightforward. So here's the real killer, that over 6% of the Iranian ballistic missiles got through combined defences of the Israelis, the Americans, the British, and a few other people in the sidelines. Now, who is this man? Well, we've talked about him before, but his key attribute is through Roussi, but he's now specialist advisor to the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy. He's served on the Prime Minister's Security Forum and Chief of Defence Staff Strategic Advisor Panel. So he should be reliable, but he's not at the moment. So was it a success for Israel? Well, things that I've looked at is the overall coordination of this type of air warfare. Very, very complex. Israel would not be taking the lead. The US would be taking the lead because the US doesn't allow people to play with their toys, their military equipment. So although Cameron in particular praising Israel's performance, the overall drive for the air defense would have come from the Americans. America would have had to work directly alongside Israel's air defense forces within Israel's national air defense zone. So this is not about Israel defending itself. This is about Israel under an umbrella of protection provided by the US in particular. The UK and other minor partners would be given a minor participatory role in air defence surveillance, and they would have been active in local air defence sectors commensurate with their air defence asset contribution, i.e. the more you put in, the bigger the say you get in the battle. If you only put a few toys into the ring, the Americans are not going to let you play with very much. And if we add a bit more to this, the US air defense has got experience within the region, but we've repeatedly seen American military bases demonstrating weaknesses and failures as they've been hit with what has been an emerging missile, drone, and electronic war technology. And I'll also add to that that we need to recognise that air defence on this scale amongst a multinational force is very difficult, even with a well-practiced military coalition such as NATO. And the cooperation with Israel was unlikely to be fully coherent because Israel has already demonstrated on numerous occasions that they will follow their own path and to hell with everybody else. So a success, well, the suggestion that Israel's Iron Dome and local supporting air defense assets achieved success and Iran's attack was a failure is complete nonsense. What we've got to look at is that Iran was attacking the best US-led air defense assets that the US could contribute from its own resources, plus Israel, Britain, and others. And against this coalition, Iran achieved multiple strikes against a prime Israeli target. And I think this is the reason that we're seeing such wobbliness in David Cameron and the rest of the Biden and the rest of the globalist politicians. This has not gone as they thought it would.
So what is the wobbliness in the UK mainstream press like? Let's have a look at Andrew Neil's absolutely unbelievable article in the Daily Mail. So the headline is, if 300 missiles and drones hit Britain, would we be sitting on our hands? Israel has a right to retaliate. And loose talk about World War III is designed to intimidate it into doing nothing. So this is what he had to say. Within hours of Iran's mass missile and drone attack on Israel overnight and on Saturday, the consensus of the global commentariat forming in newspapers and TV channels was that Israel should refrain from retaliation. If so many weapons of destruction had rained down in Britain, would we be listening to those urging caution, nodding thoughtfully at such sage advice and agreeing that it would probably be best for all concerned if we just sat on our hands? As we saw with the Argentinian invasion of the Falklands all those years ago, there would be an overwhelming national demand for a robust response to show we cannot be attacked with impunity. It's a bit ironic that he brings the Falklands into it, because we should remember, if we just put that back on screen, that it was Israel that supplied, or Israel certainly supplied Argentina with arms and weapons during the Falklands War. So it's interesting that he brings that particular conflict into the conversation. But anyway, he goes on to say, it's being said that the attack was only in response to Israel's bombing of an Iranian diplomatic mission in the Syrian capital of Damascus. Tehran says it deems its assault on Israel to be over, so Israel should just move on. But should it, for a start, this was the first attack on Israel launched from Iranian soil. That alone represents a major escalation of hostilities. Well, the escalation was from Israel in the first place, with what they did in Damascus. As many other people have said, this was in breach of international law. But anyway, Neil goes on, moreover, the command center that Israel hit in Damascus was a major base for the IRGC's Quds Force, which arms, trains and finances Iran's proxy militia across the region, including Hamas and Hezbollah, which has brought so much misery to Israel. So that makes it all right then, according to him. Iran is out to undermine Israel and humiliate America. It has had too much success in both endeavors. Israel has every right to respond to the mass attack. There's too much loose talk about it leading to World War III. If it does, this is designed to intimidate Israel into doing nothing. I find the entire article, Vanessa, I just get some very quick comment from you on it.
What, when I stop laughing?
Yeah.
I mean, what is he? I don't know what he's channeling, but it's not sane.
No, it's not sane, and that is the point here, I think.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I'm lost for words on much of it, Mike, because it's just so incredible what we're being presented with. So we'll get into this a bit more in extra time. But I'm just going to move on through, because, of course, there was a lot of stuff rattling around on social media. Somebody sent me this picture, which was supposed to represent Iran's success. So we've got a picture of some white plastic garden furniture. One of the chairs has fallen over. And Mayar Tusi says the shocking level of damage after Iran's attack last night. Now, I'm calling this out as misinformation. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. I don't think it's deliberate, but it's misinformation. But it got me looking at who this gentleman Mayar Tusi is. And according to his information, he's a pretty big, sorry, let's bring the slide on there. He's a TV founder. What I noticed on his little headline here, he's very big on free speech, apparently. But is he? Because when I went onto his Twitter page, I was fascinated to see him praising the great work of the Syrian Collective. And I was intrigued by this because I didn't really know what it was about. And so I did a little look, and it led me somewhere which I think is important for our viewers and listeners. So here's the Syrian Collective. It's a surveillance network, news opinions. It's pro-democracy, apparently. It's scraping digital fingerprints to aggressively track and expose anti-Semitism. Now I started to get a bit more curious, because I didn't see a lot of democracy in what they're doing. I saw something rather different. But if we bring in what they say about themselves, the Syrian Collective stands as a formidable Jewish surveillance group born from the necessity to combat rising anti-Semitism. In the wake of October the 7th revealing event, Syrian has taken a staunch stance against hatred and bigotry, employing advanced digital tactics to shield the Jewish community. It says, renowned for its unyielding spirit, embodied in a rallying cry. The collective calls upon global allies to join in their defensive crusade with a communication style that is as direct as it is forceful. Syrian is relentless in its mission to expose and neutralize anti-Semitic elements. Now, I think this is a veiled threat. That's my opinion. I may be wrong.
I'm not sure it's too veiled, but anyway.
Well, exactly. And it goes on to talk about the Maccabee Project. We're back into priests in Israel pre-Jesus Christ. At the heart of Syrian's operation lies the Maccabee Project, a sophisticated AI-driven tool designed for modern digital warfare against anti-Semitism. Maccabee excels in automated monitoring, reporting and awareness raising, especially in sensitive sectors, by harnessing data for precise identification and targeted action. Maccabee operates on an omni-channel basis for maximum impact. And it says, while navigating the complexities of legal frameworks, Maccabee ensures a lasting influence on identified targets. And I don't get a warm feeling for this. I think this is a very aggressive little organization. The Guardian did have a look at it earlier in the year, but they failed to ask any key questions about its identity, legitimacy, or possible links to Israeli State Intelligence Unit 8200. And to remind people, the UK column was very big on this back in 2015, where we pointed out that Francis Maude, as Cabinet Office Minister, was setting up these surveillance and intelligence links with the Israelis. And Unit 8200, Israel's cyber spy agency, featured very deeply. We put together this little diagram showing all of the links that he was setting up. And it didn't just include conservative friends of Israel. Of course, it was bringing in connections between Israeli and British universities, University of Bristol coming on screen. But it was also tied in with Ministry of Science, Technology and Space in Israel, University of Kent. And let's add a bit more over here. Here's GCHQ working with Israeli Defense Force Unit 8200. Digital companies there, and also at the time, Common Purpose, our old friend, was in the background. So I don't know what this organisation is, Mike, but I don't get a warm feeling about it. And as we said at the time, that if a memorandum of understanding was being put together with Israel, we were voting effectively conservative, but getting Israel. The key question in the small print is, did we ever vote for any of this? And the answer is we didn't. But I find it extremely disturbing to see social media pushing these sorts of organizations that if we say one word wrong against Israel, we've got some group on our backs. I think this is very, very dangerous stuff.
Well, Tehran calling, says Policy Exchange. And just by coincidence, I'm sure they had, it was just by coincidence, Policy Exchange has released this new report today, which is all about the egregious nature of Tehran's interference in the UK. We'll come on to what they say. Here they say the United Kingdom has now experienced over three decades of Iranian influence and power projection within its borders, from the Rushdie Fatwa in 1989 to the 2022 cinema protests against the blasphemous Lady of Heaven movie, to the current threats to Iranian dissidents and journalists based in the United Kingdom. They say, as Iranian flags fly at pro-Palestinian protests in this country, this report details how the Islamic Republic of Iran constitutes a multidimensional threat to British society, one that requires urgent government action. Iran is presently a hostile state to Britain, listed alongside China and Russia as an opponent in security service statements. It seeks to interfere with our online systems and takes British citizens hostage. Now, who are they talking about here? Well, of course, if we're talking about one country's interference in another country, we need to look at who they're talking about here, because they're talking about Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who, if we remember, had spent time in prison in Iran, and then ended up in under house arrest in Iran before finally being released. Now, the Iranian government saying that, and she was convicted of subversive interference in Iranian society, and this was related to her work with Thomson Reuters Foundation and BBC Media Action, who are media development organizations. So if we remember at the time, this was the comment from Monique Villa, the COO of Thomson Reuters Foundation, saying when Zachary Ratcliffe was originally charged, that these charges are linked to her work at BBC Media Action and at the Thomson Reuters Foundation. This is a complete invention, as the Thomson Reuters Foundation doesn't work in Iran and there's no program or dealings with Iran. Well, of course, it's not a complete invention, because BBC Media Action certainly had activities in Iran up until her arrest anyway. So this is from the Media Landscapes website talking about Iran. BBC Media Action used to work in media and communication in Iran, although through training and long-term mentoring. At the moment, it is no longer operative in the country. And Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, a dual British and Iranian citizen, is currently in jail in Tehran because of her previous work with the organization. Now, this is historic, of course, because she has been released and is back in the UK. But if we remember, while Boris Johnson was Foreign Secretary, he acknowledged what she was doing, although he wasn't supposed to acknowledge what she was doing. So when we look at what Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe was doing, he said she was simply teaching people journalism, as I understand it, at the very limit. But Vanessa, the key point here is what these people are doing in these countries isn't just teaching people journalism.
No, absolutely not. I mean, we know this from, who was it, Juliet Harkin?
Well, we're going to come on to her in a second. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. But yeah, I mean, we know, sorry, I've spoiled your surprise. But we know that, you know, that they're effectively scouts and infiltrators prior to a planned destabilization campaign, regime change, whatever it may be, to basically influence or to pinpoint, identify potential opposition and to work on them, basically, within
yes.
the society.
Indeed. And so if we bring this Consortium News article on screen, then, and this is entitled Reuters, BBC, in covert UK programme to push Western agenda. They're talking about Russia, of course, in this case, but as we'll see, this goes well beyond Russia. The new leaks illustrate in alarming detail how Reuters and the BBC, two of the largest and most distinguished news organisations in the world, attempted to answer the British Foreign Ministry's call for help in improving its ability to respond and to promote our message across Russia and to counter the Russian government's narrative. And this was related to the Foreign Office's counter-disinformation and media development program. Not just Russia, not just Iran, also Kazakhstan, many other countries as well. If you haven't seen this article on the UK Column website on BBC Media Action, please read it. And we'll bring the lovely Juliet Harkin on screen now, because she was talking about her activities in Syria under BBC Media Action. BBC Media Action worked in 2004 with individuals within the Syrian ministry who wanted change and tried to get them to be the drivers of that. All media development work that's been done in Syria has, in my opinion, been predicated upon this idea that there can be change from within. So the point here is that if Policy Exchange is suggesting that Iran has been active in this way in the UK, UK has been active in this way in Iran and in many other countries. It's absolutely part of the core of what British foreign policy is. So coming back to the Policy Exchange document then, Iran has spent several decades, they said, curating a political-religious infrastructure in Britain. This centres on what is characterised here as the Islamic Republic's UK nerve centre, the Islamic Centre of England Limited in Maida Vale, West London. So here is the website for that. They're claiming that this is the centre of Iran's influence operation in the UK. Indeed, but they then go on to criticise the fact that MI5 is no longer taking part in counter-subversion activities. And they say that indeed subversion, once a core task of MI5, appears to have been removed from the contemporary focus of the security service. Until recently, its website stated we no longer undertake counter-subversion work. This would only resume doing so if our monitoring of emerging threats suggests an increase in the subversive threat. So this was the website as it was, and that's where they made that comment. In fact, the current MI5 website, when you look at what they do, discusses three main areas: countering terrorism, countering state threats, and protective security. And I would argue that countering state threats absolutely is what has taken replaced the counter-surveillance, counter, what was the word?
counter-surveillance, no countering state threat.
No, doesn't matter anyway.
There's too much here. Yes. We're going to be honest with our audience today. There is so much here, Mike, in this subject. It's difficult to keep up with it all.
Yeah, but anyway, the point here is MI5 stating that state threats are overt or covert actions by foreign governments which fall short of direct armed conflict with the UK, but go beyond peaceful diplomacy and expected statecraft to harm or threaten the safety or interests of the UK or allies. So the suggestion by the policy exchange that MI5 is suddenly off the pitch with respect to activities, soft power activities from foreign nations is completely incorrect and disingenuous and misleading. But in any case, I would question their entire basis of their report. And I would certainly question any suggestion that Iran is doing anything unusual or different to anything else. And in fact, it's doing it on a much smaller, if it is doing it at all, it's doing it on a much smaller basis than the UK is, never mind the United States. So we'll leave that there. Vanessa, you sent me this earlier and I just wanted to highlight it. So this is apparently, according to Israeli media, at least one of the holes left in the ground by one of the rockets that was fired by Iran. And I just want to ask the question, because that's quite a convenient pile of earth over on the left-hand side there. And I wonder if you were to turn that pile of earth, I'd be interested in your views, Vanessa, if you were to turn that pile of earth upside down and put it into that hole, do you think it would fit?
Well, there were an awful lot of bulldozers lying around in the video of the hole also. So I would suggest it's extremely possible that it would fit perfectly, yes.
Yes, indeed. Okay, thank you for that. And we're just going to end this segment then with a bit of video from Julian Assange in 2011. And I think it might give a little bit of context for what we're witnessing at the moment, not just in the Middle East, but also in Ukraine, in fact.
Because the goal is not to completely subjugate Afghanistan. The goal is to use Afghanistan to wash money out of the tax bases of the United States, out of the tax bases of European countries, through Afghanistan and back into the hands of a transnational security elite. That is the goal, i.e. the goal is to have an endless war, not a successful war.
An endless war, not a successful war. You agree with that?
Absolutely. He was on the money, no question of it.
Okay. If you like what the UK Column does, you would like to support us, please head over to support.ukcolumn.org. All the options for helping us out are there. You could share anything you find on the various platforms, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. But please also consider having a look at what's on the UK Column shop, a number of different items there for you to have a look at and perhaps pick up and help us out that way as well. Now, tomorrow at 1 p.m, we've got an interview with Dr. Charles Hoffa, who, of course, is experiencing some serious pressure from the Canadian authorities over his activities during the COVID so-called crisis. I just want to join us for that at 1 p.m. tomorrow, but just want to also mention he has a legal defense fund going. The link for that will be in the show notes. If you can possibly help out with that, that would be great. I'd like to mention an event taking place in Norwich on Saturday, the 20th of April, 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. What actually is 5G? A talk on the pros and cons of 5G and the implications of AI by Ian Jarvis. If you would like to get along to that, I'm sure they would appreciate it. Another reminder of the Science Beautiful Festival taking place in 2024 in June 27th to the 30th in Wimborne and Dorset. We will be at that one, please join us for that if you can. And also Stand in the Light in May, which is taking place in Cumbria, May 24th to the 27th. Join us for that one as well, because we'll also be at that.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Mike. And I'd just like to give a reminder of the work going on by the Fenethi ladies, the survivors of abuse at Fenethi Residential School. I've just got some generic images on screen, but obviously they've been fighting for 4.5 years for access to Scotland's redress scheme, which gives them recognition as survivors and also helps them, and also for some will allow compensation for problems that they've had. But this is a very difficult battle for them. Now, we've mentioned that they do need some money. We've got a little video clip actually to play here, because they had a video embedded in their crowdfunder. And I just want to play it, but to say to our audience, they're trying to raise £1,000, which helps them pay for coaches, for example, to travel. It helps them draw the women together. This is not a huge amount of money, and I would very much like to see UK Column audience helping the Fenethi ladies to raise that £1,000. Let's just look at the video embedded in the crowdfunder itself.
If you have lots of people saying that the same thing happened to them, yes, it starts to look quite unlikely. But it starts to look quite unlikely that something different happened.
But I'm not disputing what the women are saying for a second. Let me be really, really clear. I believe absolutely what they're saying. What I'm saying to you, though, is that Redress Scotland require some evidence of someone being placed into a setting, and there is no record for anybody.
So a little bit abrupt, but it's very telling. The women know they were abused. There's a lot of women. There's hundreds of them. They know where they were abused. It was at Fenethi. But according to the Deputy First Minister, Shona Robison, she needs the evidence they were at the school. It's horrific, Mike, I think is the right word. So if there's any of the audience who feel they can help financially, please do. Let's see whether we can raise that £1,000.
And I just want to reiterate here, this is Shona Robison, not Robinson, and she's no relation.
So I did try and stress that, Mike, for you. Yes.
Okay, now, next Monday on the 22nd, we will be premiering Playing God. This is the new documentary from Jackie Devoy, and it will be, we'll be premiering that immediately following the UK Column News at 2 p.m. next Monday. So a reminder about that, and please join us for it. But I just wanted to bring us forward a little bit, because last week we were talking about this, the opinion piece, I think it was in the Times, by Matthew Paris talking about assisted suicide. You know, amongst other things, he was saying within a decade or more, assisted suicide will be seen as a normal road for many to take and be considered socially responsible, even finally urged upon people. So this is a direction that we're heading in. And so this is an area that we've been looking at again. And I just wanted to bring this up. It's been doing the rounds of social media at the moment. This is the palliative care funding review that took place in 2011. Just to give an idea of some of the background about how we got to this place with respect to the democide and deaths in hospitals and so on. So this is entitled Funding the Right Care and Support for Everyone. And the key thing in this is the changing demo, or at least one of the key aspects of this is changing demographics. And they're saying a new funding model must take into account the aging demographic, the scale and complexity of need generated by patient populations, and the need to jointly commission health and social care efficiently. And they're quoting the British Geriatrics Society there. And so they're, I guess, basing the expected number of deaths between 2011 and 2031 based on population rise. Of course, some of that population rise is natural and some of it is because of people being brought into the country. But nonetheless, they're saying that by 2031, we can expect there to be 410,496 deaths each year by 2031. So that's one report to have a look at. The next one that I wanted to bring on was this, developing a new approach to palliative care funding. This is the final report for 2015 and 2016. There's a lot more research needed to be done on this. And if anybody's willing to help with that, I very much appreciate it, because I'm very keen to understand what is meant by the term palliative care development currency. Okay, so to get an idea of what this means, let's have a look at hospice website, eHospice, sorry, and they published an article, Have Your Say in Developing a Palliative Care Currency. And just to take a quote from this, NHS England is currently developing the currency for palliative care, essentially a way of grouping patients according to their needs and likely cost of their care. The aim is to provide a transparent basis for palliative care commissioning. And they say from April 2015, a development currency will be available. This version of the currency will be tested further during 2015-2016. It will not be mandatory and will have no associated prices. And so it goes on. It says a draft currency is planned for publication on the 23rd of October to allow the palliative care community, including clinicians, commissioners and providers, to help shape the development of the currency. So I have to say, I'm somewhat confused about what this is. Are they talking in currency in terms of money, in the sense of the cost of, you know, how much it costs to keep someone alive, and whether you use that to make a decision on whether they die or not, whether they get pumped full of midazolam and other stuff, or what is it? So this is just wanted to put that out in this news program and ask for a bit of help from people to understand what this means.
What this language means, yeah. Okay, thank you for that, Mike. Well, we're just going to end, it's a positive note, but with a twist, of course, because we're in 2024. But Andrew Bridgen and other MPs wrote to the Office of National Statistics, basically to ask for help with regard to public safety around deaths. And so what they said in the letter was that, unfortunately, the parameters chosen by the authority, National Office of Statistics, are insufficient to make a dispositive determination as to whether the vaccines are safe and effective or not, because the interval sizes were too few and too large. The UK statistics regulator agrees and said, our view is that the deaths by vaccination status publication does not provide information on vaccine effectiveness and vaccine safety and should not be used. We're requesting that the authority redo the analysis with the following parameters, and they suggested some additional parameters which we believe will provide definitive insight as to whether or not the COVID vaccines are safe and effective or not. This will help us to address an important question we're currently facing in Parliament regarding excess mortality and what is causing it. So this is a really important letter where these MPs, Andrew Bridgen and colleagues, are saying we need some help to sort out where these figures are coming for excess mortality. Let's look very quickly at the reply that they got back from the UK Statistics Authority. And we'd have to do this quickly as end of the news. But they say, as you observe in your letter, the Office of Statistics Regulation has published a view on ONS deaths by vaccination status analysis. OSR state the analysis was developed in response to user requests during the pandemic to understand the vaccination status of people who die from COVID-19. As the ONS makes clear in its publication, this analysis is not intended to be, nor is it appropriate for, understanding vaccine effectiveness. The OSR also stated, we would advise use of the weekly COVID-19 vaccine surveillance report published by the UK Health Security Agency instead. This looks at a range of measures of vaccine effectiveness, including effectiveness against infection, transmission, hospitalisation and mortality. And I said a very long and winding reply. I think actually I should have said a smoke screen. I think you'll get the idea. Let's go into the second page. You can see the amount of text in their reply. The attribution of excess deaths is incredibly complex and beyond the current scope of the ONS methodology. The UK HSA have estimated the excess deaths due to acute factors such as heat waves, cold snaps, COVID-19 and influenza. I acknowledge that all the driving factors behind excess deaths are not fully understood. The excess is likely to be the net effect of many complex and potentially related factors, which ONS is committed to exploring further with our partners across the government statistical system in health. So this is much too complex, apparently, for the ONS to deal with. And if we go to the final one here, another full page of bump, but they say this, considering the above, ONS does not believe that the analysis you've requested would add substantial high-quality insight to the existing evidence base. In light of the limitations to the analysis proposed, ONS does not judge it to be a priority to undertake. Given current resource constraints, ONS needs to ensure that we undertake analysis that contributes new robust insight and which, quote, offers the public value for money, unquote. So we're not going to investigate excess deaths because we don't want to do it, because we're going to give the public better value for money.
Yes.
It is impossible to deliver the news in the UK in 2024 in a coherent way, because we are dealing now with what is clearly madness and some of it extremely dangerous, like that response from the ONS. So we'll be interested to see where Andrew Bridgen and his colleagues go. On that rather unhappy note, we're going to have to end today's news. Vanessa, thank you very much for joining us. Do join us for Extra, UK Column Extra, if you're a member. And we'll be having a look at more detail of what's been happening in Israel and the Iran attack. But otherwise, to our international audience, thank you very much for joining us today. And thank you to everybody that supports UK Column financially, because we can only do what we do with your financial support. Thanks very much for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.